Vayishma Yisro, Mashmu Ashoma Uba. The Pasuk says, Vayishma Yisro, Eskol Asheros Hashem Yisrael. That Yisro heard everything that the Rabbanu Shalom did. So why does Rashi mention only two things? Why does Rashi mention only Kriyas Yamsuf and Milchemes HaMalik? So I think one possible answer is the following. The Pasuk's telling us what Yisro heard. But Rashi's telling us what of that which Yisro heard prompted him to come and join the Jewish people. He heard everything. He could have stayed where he was and become a believer in God, as he says that this is what impressed him. Kriyas Yamsuf impressed him to believe in God. He sees now that there's a God who controls nature, who punishes the wicked, Mida Keneged Mida. Why do you have to come and join the Jewish people? Could have stayed where he was and become a believer. What was the necessity? Uba. That's what Rashi is telling us. Mashmua Shoma Uba. What necessitated him from all the things that he heard to come and join the Jewish people? And that says he's heard Kriyas Yamsuf and Milchemes HaMalik. I think there's two ideas inherent in this. And it also supplements how a person has to listen to things and how it has to make an impression on you. Yisro heard Kriyas Yamsuf. And he assumed, I think, that this miracle made such a profound impression on him that there's no way that he's ever going to forget it, and the effect is never going to wear off. And if that's the case, then he can stay where he is and be impressed and influenced, and he doesn't need to do anything more. And then, a few days later, he heard about Milchemes HaMalek. HaMalek also heard of Kriyas Yamsuf. And yet, the effect on them wore off very, very quickly, where they were willing now to attack the Jewish people. The Klal Yisrael was like an ambati rosachas, Rashi says. They were like a hot, boiling hot bath. Everybody was afraid to touch them. And it didn't take long for the effect on Amalek to wear off, and they jumped into the hot bath, not being afraid. And they cooled us off in the eyes of all the nations of the world. So that's what Yisro heard. He heard that you could have a Kriyas Yamsuf with such a tremendous effect, and it doesn't take long for the effect to wear off, and within days already, it's possible for people to come and attack Klal Yisrael. So he realized it's going to wear off on him too. I heard a tremendous vort from Rabbi Yaakov Weinberg, Zatzal, the former Rosh Hashiv of Ner Yisrael. He said the following. He says that after Eliyahu HaNavi convinced Klal Yisrael that God is true and the Baal is false at Har HaKarmel, when the fire came down in Hashemayim and consumed his korban and not the korban of the Nevi'ei HaBaal, and everybody proclaimed Hashem Hu Elokim. So he goes home and he finds a messenger there from Izevel. And the messenger tells him that Izevel is going to kill him tomorrow. That she sent him a message. Right? Tomorrow I'm going to kill you. And Eliyahu goes berserk. And he runs out into the desert. And 40 days he goes without eating. And he finally comes to Har Sinai. And basically his mission in this world is finished then. He can't take it anymore. So Weinberg asked, Izevel has been trying to kill Eliyahu his entire life. Right? She is a Rishita. This was not his first encounter with her. Why all of a sudden is it so difficult for him to accept the fact that she wants to kill him? Secondly, if you want to kill somebody, you don't usually send them a message, could you please be around tomorrow, I'd like to kill you. You try to surprise them. So why in the world did Izevel send a message to Eliyahu, I'm going to kill you tomorrow? Said Rabbi Weinberg that Eliyahu HaNavi felt that he so impressed Klal Yisrael, that's it. From now on, they're going to be true believers and no more problems. Yezebel sent him the following message. You should know that today you're the hero. Today you prove that God is God and the Baal is false, and if I would want to kill you today, they'd tear me limb from limb in protecting you. But you know what? Tomorrow I'm going to kill you. And tomorrow the effect will have worn off enough that the people will let me kill you. And Eliyahu knew she was right, and he couldn't take it. Miracles do not last long. People see miracles, it makes an impression, and it wears off very quickly. And you go back to your normal existence. And therefore, when Yisro heard, he heard Kriyas Yamsuf, and he heard that within days afterwards, the effect could wear off Amalek and permit them to attack Klal Yisrael, then it's going to wear off of him too eventually, and if he doesn't come and constantly strengthen it, then he's going to lose the whole effect of Kriyas Yamsuf. With that, I want to explain another medrash. Very difficult medrash, I think. It says that Yisro said, Baruch Hashem, Hashir Itzil Eschem Miyad Mitzrayim. And the medrash says that from the time they left Mitzrayim, no one said Baruch Hashem until Yisro came along and said Baruch Hashem. That means all the Makos, Makos Bechoros, Klal Yisrael left Mitzrayim. They saw Kriyas Yamsuf. Not one Jew said Baruch Hashem. I mean, you would expect at least, you know, some old grandmother said Baruch Hashem. I say Baruch Hashem on everything. No Jew said Baruch Hashem. How could that be? Yisro was the only one, first one to say Baruch Hashem. So it could be the idea is the following. The word Baruch, according to the Rashba, according to the Nefesh HaChaim, its real meaning means to increase. Comes from the word Brecha, a spring which constantly increases its waters. So when you say a bracha, you mean, Rabbanu Shalom, you attached yourself to the world with a certain influence. I want that influence to be increased. Baruch Ata Hashem. So that's what Baruch means. Baruch means to increase. Klal Yisrael saw all the Nisim, Mitzrayim, Kriyas Yamsuf, and they assumed that it's never going to wear off. There's nothing to say Baruch about. There's nothing to increase. They've reached the pinnacle, and it's going to remain like that. But Yisro from afar saw Kriyas Yamsuf, and he saw Milchemes Amalek, and he realized that if you don't do something to strengthen what you saw and what you heard and constantly increase it, it's going to wear off. So he's the first person who said Baruch Hashem. Klal Yisrael didn't say Baruch. They said all different kinds of Shira and all different kinds of thanks, but the word Baruch they didn't think was necessary because there's nothing that could be added. There's nothing that we could possibly do to add to this, to the show we saw. And they were wrong, because things wear off and you constantly have to strengthen and add it. That's one way of understanding what Yisro saw that prompted him to come and join Klal Yisro. Another possibility is the following. Yisro heard about Kriyas Yamsuf. By Kriyas Yamsuf, he saw that the Rabbanu Shel Olam said, right, Hashem Yelochim Lochem V'Atem Tacharishu. You sit tight. You don't have to fight. God will fight your battles. You just sit tight, and the Rabbanu Shel Olam will fight your battles. He'll take care. Nope. Yisro says, okay, now I know how God functions. A few days later, he hears that the Jewish people are attacked by Amalek. What does he assume? So what happens now when people attack Klal Yisrael? They sit tight, and the Rabbanu Shel Olam wages their battles. What happened by Amalek? Not like that. The Rabbanu Shel Olam told Moshe, say, Hilochim ba'Amalek. Go, and what's it called? Tell Yoshua tomorrow to go out and fight with Amalek. And they had to make the battle. Why? When it came to Kriyas Yamsuf, the Jews didn't fight. And when it came to Amalek, they had to fight. And there are many reasons given. One is that they couldn't fight against the Egyptians, who had been to a terrible Kfiyas HaTov, because they were, the Egyptians at least gave them a place to be, right? Even though they enslaved them, but they also lived in their land, and for a period in history, the Egyptians did us very fine favors. So to fight them would have been Kfiyas HaTov. So therefore we didn't fight them. Amalek is a different story. According to others, the first battle, the Rabbanu Shalom wanted to show that ultimately, if you're victorious or not, it's my doing. After that, we have to make the Ishtadlus. After that, we have to fight. Or Amalek was Mitzrayim was a physical danger. Physical dangers the Rabbanu Shalom takes care of. But a spiritual danger, Hakol Bidei Shamayim, Chutz Miyur Shamayim, you have to fight when it's a spiritual danger. That's why Purim time, right, the Rabbanu Shalom took care. And Hanukkah time, we had a fight. Okay, whatever the reason is, there's a reason why by Amalek we had to fight, and by Kriyas Yamsuf, the Rabbanu Shalom fought our battles. But what did Yisrael see from that? You can't assume that because something was some way one time, it's the same way it's going to be a different time. So I can't stay here and say that I understand how the Rabbanu Shalom functions in the world and what he expects of me, because it changes. So I'm going to have to go and join Klal Yisrael and listen to Moshe Rabbeinu, who will tell us what Ratzon Hashem is in any specific situation. Because the Ratzon Hashem in different situations changes itself. It's not the same in every situation. Because it was like that by Kriyas Yamsuf doesn't mean it's going to be the same way by Milchemes Amalek. And if it's not consistent and constant, then you need to be exposed to Gedolei Yisrael and to the people who speak in the name of the Ribbono Shel Olam to know what Ratzon Hashem is at that moment. Okay. With that, I want to go to another part of the Sedra with a similar idea. Torah says, Chodesh Hashlishi, Letzeis Bnei Yisrael Mi'eres Mitzrayim, Bayom Hazeh Bo Midbar Sinai. So Chazal say, it doesn't say Bayom Ahu, it says Bayom Hazeh, today, this day, that we learn from that every day the Torah should be new to you like it was given that day. So the simple idea is that Torah shouldn't be an old thing that you got used to, should always have that excitement of being something new. But it can't mean that, because few reasons. First of all, there are other places in the Torah we learn that same limud from, right? V'hoyu hadvarim ho'eila shanochi mitzavcho hayom al levavecha. Every day the Torah should be new to you. The mitzvahs in Torah should be new, as if it was given that day, something new. So why do I need it over here? I have it over there. Secondly, the Torah wasn't given that day. Torah wasn't given till the 6th or 7th of Sivan. And Bayom Hazeh Bo Midbar Sinai is Rosh Chodesh Sivan. So what do you tell me? Okay, it was a process. From Rosh Chodesh Sivan till the 7th day of Sivan was the process of giving the Torah. So Matan Torah is the whole process. It's not true, because the process didn't start till the 2nd day of Sivan. The Gemara says that on the first day, the Rabbanu Shalom didn't say a word. He didn't call Moshe Rabbeinu, he didn't speak to him, Moshe didn't speak to the people. They were tired from traveling, and the Rabbanu Shalom let them rest and unpack. That was it. That's all that happened on Rosh Chodesh Sivan. All the process of giving the Torah started on the second day of Sivan. So how in the world can we learn from Rosh Chodesh Sivan that by Yom HaZeh, Bol Midbar Sinai, that every day should be new to you like the Torah was given that day, if the Torah wasn't even given that day? Therefore, I think that the lesson is a different lesson completely. It's not the lesson that the Torah should be new and exciting. Different idea completely. Don't you think that the Ribbono Shel Olam would have wanted to give the Torah as soon as possible, to get the process starting as soon as possible? He waited from before the world was created for this moment. There had to be a certain amount of Jews in a certain place at the right time, and then the Torah could be given. And that's what happened. There's enough Jews, and they're in the right place, and this is the right time, so let's get started. So why didn't the Rabban Shalom start the process right then on that day? Because the Rabban Shalom looked at the situation and he assessed that the people were tired. And if he would start chepping them with Matan Torah that day, it would be counterproductive. It wouldn't have accomplished anything. They were too tired from traveling. So the Rabban Shalom let them rest that day. And he started the next day. That's what we learn from there. Every day, your relationship to Torah has to be assessed anew according to the circumstances of that day. Sometimes you're raring to go, push yourself. Sometimes you're tired, you gotta rest that day. You have to constantly assess the Torah anew, and you can't function because yesterday we did this, today we're gonna do the same thing. Yesterday's circumstances were different than today's circumstances. And every situation, you have to take into consideration, the Torah doesn't change, but how we relate to the Torah changes. And every situation, every day, every year, every place, you have to reassess your relationship to Torah based on the factors that exist. Let me give you a few examples. The Torah doesn't change, but our relationship to Torah changes because factors change. Let me give you two examples to that. The Michtam Eliyahu says that every generation has its Yetzer Hara. And the way to fight the Yetzer Hara is with the tools of the Yetzer Hara himself. He gives an example. In the Rambam's time, the Yetzer Hara was Greek philosophy, Aristotle. That was the Yetzer Hara of the time. People were enamored with Aristotle. They believed that everything he said was true. And even where Aristotle differed with the Torah, Aristotle was right. That was the Avodah Zarah of the time. So what did the Rambam do? He wrote Mora Nevuchim to guide the perplexed people and show them that yes, many things Aristotle was right. But where Aristotle differed with the Torah, Aristotle was wrong. That was part of the thrust of Mora Nevuchim. Now, if you don't think that how we relate to the Torah changes, then I don't know why there are so many different Kiruv organizations with all different kinds of gimmicks or whatever. L'chaora, I'll tell you, if you want to be Makarev people, I'll tell you what to do. You should make copies of Mora Nevuchim in the language that people understand. Go to Kikar Tzion, call all of these estranged Jews out of the pubs, and tell them, I know why you're estranged from Judaism, because you think Aristotle is the final word of truth. So I will read you some selected passages from Mora Nevuchim, and you will be Makariv hundreds and hundreds of people, right? Wrong. You won't Makariv anybody. You know why? Because the Yetzer Hara of this generation is not Aristotle. It's not Greek philosophy. It's not any philosophy. They don't even know who Aristotle is. Most of them think he's a rock star. The Yetzer Hara of this generation, you'll excuse me, is not deep thought or philosophy, right? The deepest thought that most people of this generation are capable of is, should I put ketchup or mustard on my hamburger? And even that's too difficult for them, so they just leave it up to the people who make it. That's not the Yetzer Hara. And therefore, you're not going to reach people like that. The Torah didn't change, but people change how they relate to the Torah. And therefore, you have to deal with the situation as it is and reassess it in every generation. Another example. When they established the Chinuch Atzmoi schools here in Eretz Yisrael, the question came, what language is going to be the language of instruction in the Chinuch Atzmoi schools? So many people assumed that whatever language it's going to be, it's not going to be Ivrit. It's not going to be modern Hebrew. Because the Yishuv HaYoshev, Rav Yosef Chaim Sonnenfeld and others, made a holy war against Ivrit. They wouldn't speak it, and they only spoke Yiddish on purpose. And in fact, there's a story that goes like this, that Rabbi Yosef Chaim Sonnenfeld once met the father of modern Hebrew, the Eliezer ben Yehuda. And Eliezer ben Yehuda said to him, I don't understand what you have against Hebrew. Hebrew is Lashon HaKodesh. Why do you refuse to speak Ivrit? Why are you making a war against Hebrew? It's Lashon HaKodesh. So Rabbi Yosef Chaim Sonnenfeld told him the following. He said, wine is very, very holy. We use wine for Kiddush and Havdalah and Sheva Brachas and a host of other things of Kedusha that wine is involved with. But if the wrong kinds of people touch the wine becomes usher. It says in Shir HaShirim, Chikeich ki yein hatov, your palate, your mouth, is like wine. Just like wine, can be very kodesh, but if the wrong people touch it, it becomes usher. So too, language can be kodesh, but if the wrong people like you touch it, it becomes usher. So supposedly, Eliezer ben Yehuda said, Harav medaber shtusim, to which Rabbi Yosef Chaim Sonnenfeld said, Be'ivrit omrim shtuyot. In any case, whether that happened or not, I'm not sure, but it's a nice story. So, they assumed that the language of instruction in the Chinuch Atzmoi Torah schools not going to be Ivrit. They went to the Chazon Ish to make the decision what should be the language of instruction in the Beis Yaakov's, in the Chinuch Atzmoi elementary schools, and the Chazon Ish said, we are going to teach in modern Hebrew. That's exactly what the Beis Yaakov's teaching, Ivrit. So there you already put signs up in Mea Sharim to put the Chazon Ish in Cherem, right? He has already became a Zionist, he went off the Derech. So they went to ask him, how could it be? Yosef Chaim Sonnenfeld made a holy war against Ivrit, and you Paskin, they should teach Ivrit in our schools? And Chazon Ish said the following. He said, if you had a general who was an expert strategist in World War I, and he won many, many battles, and now it's World War II, and you take that general out of retirement, and you ask him to write up a strategy for an air battle, and he writes you a strategy that's befitting box planes, put him back into retirement, because there aren't any more box planes fighting in World War II. They're jets, propeller planes. The strategy has to fit the time. And true, the Torah doesn't change, but the situation changed. Rabbi Yosef Chaim Sonnenfeld was fighting a generation who grew up in frum homes, who threw off the yoke of Torah, and they felt guilty. So they needed a substitute for Torah. So Eretz Yisrael and Lashon HaKodesh, Hebrew and Eretz Yisrael, took the place of Torah and Mitzvahs. As long as you live in Israel and you speak Hebrew, that's enough of a Jewish identity. You don't need Torah and Mitzvahs. In Golis you need Torah and Mitzvahs. Not in Eretz Yisrael. That was their philosophy. So Rabbi Yosef Chaim Sonnenfeld had to fight that philosophy. So he fought it by saying, we're not even going to speak your Hebrew. If you think that's the main thing in life, living in Eretz Yisrael and speaking Hebrew, we're not even going to speak your Hebrew. So he fought that specific war. Chazon Ish said, 2-3 generations have passed. We're not dealing with people who need a substitute for Torah and Mitzvahs. We're dealing with people who are third generation estranged from Yiddishkeit, who have no idea what it's all about. They don't need Eretz Yisrael and Lashon HaKodesh and Ivrit as a substitute for Torah and Mitzvahs. They have no idea what Torah and Mitzvahs are. It's a different battle. And if we're not going to teach in the vernacular, in the language that's spoken, we're going to lose a whole generation. So it's a different war, different battle. You need different strategy. You need a different Caleb. And therefore now we're going to teach in Ivrit. In Yosef Chaim Sonnenfeld's time in Hanami, there it was wrong. And even though the Torah doesn't change, but how we relate to the Torah changes. Give you another example from what's Osir and what's Mutter. The truth is, I was going to say this in the next class, but say it here. In Parshas Shmos, I think maybe even we mentioned it before I left. HaKadosh Baruch Hu told us to take Egyptian clothing and to put it on our children when we go out into the Midbar. L'chora, for 210 years, one of the zechuyos that we had to go out of Mitzrayim is that we didn't wear Egyptian clothing. So why in the world would the Rabban Shem tell us to take Egyptian clothing, put it on our children? What do you want to teach us with that? So I think the lesson was that there is nothing intrinsically wrong with Egyptian clothing. That it can't be shatnez because they couldn't wear it. It can't be natsanua because they couldn't wear it. So if you go through the four halakim of Shulchan Aruch, you won't find anything wrong with that Egyptian clothing. It was 100% glatt kosher clothing. Yet, had you worn that clothing the last 210 years of Mitzrayim, you never would have gone out. How could it be? How could it be glatt kosher clothing? And yet, if they wore it in Mitzrayim, they wouldn't have gone out. The answer is simple. If you wear it in the desert, you judge it on its own merits. And if there's nothing wrong with it from the four halakim, the Shulchan Aruch, then it's no problem. But had you worn that clothing in Mitzrayim, you would have worn it to be like a Mitzri. That's treif. And I don't remember, did we speak about this before I left? Don't remember. I'll tell you a story that goes along with it. Two stories. So make the point even greater. That things depend on time and place. You can't decide what's usher and what's mutter in a vacuum. When I was in high school, the rage in the world were the Beatles. Not the six-legged variety, but the two-legged variety. The Beatles were a rock band from Liverpool, and they started a fad in the world that didn't exist before then. Before the Beatles, the only men that had long hair were either hippies, bohemians, right, or whatever, not regular, average, respectable men. Didn't grow long hair. The Beatles had long hair, especially their drummer, and since the fad in the world was the Beatles, people wanted to be like them. So men, respectable men, businessmen, doctors, lawyers, started growing long hair. And that became a fashion in the Goyish world. Whatever affects the Goyish world eventually affects the Jewish world. And in the Masifta and the Jewish high school in Miami that I attended, some of my friends stopped taking haircuts. And in about 2-3 months, it started looking like a co-ed school. So, one Friday, my Rebbeim called in these boys and told them the following. You are to go and get a normal man's haircut for the covered Shabbos. Because if you don't, and you show up Sunday with the long hair, you are suspended. You can't come back until you get a normal haircut. My friends were not daunted by that. And they said, Rebbe, a Nazir grows his hair long. And he's holy. We just want to be holy people. So we're growing our hair long. And then they said, Rebbe, do you ever see a picture of the Ragachover Gon? The Ragachover was the Rav in the same place that the Or Sameach was, right? In Dvinsk. Right. The Ragachover was the Chassidish Rav in Dvinsk, where the Or Sameach, the Meshech Chochma, was the Rav, the Litvish Rav, and he had a tremendously big head of hair. And they say the reason is he never took off his yarmulke because he never stopped learning. So he never had a chance to take a haircut. So he grew a big head of hair. He said, Rebbe, want to be like the Ragachover? My Rebbeim were not daunted by that, and they told him, Sunday you have a short haircut or you don't come back. Why? L'chora, Nazir has long hair, and the Ragachover had long hair. The answer is simple. could be that there is absolutely nothing wrong halachically with a man having long hair. You can go from one end of the Shulchan Aruch to the other, and it could be you will find no reason that a man can't have long hair. But if the reason you want to have long hair is to be like the Beatles, that's treif. So it depends on time and place. What is okay in one place and one time could be in a different place and a different time is 100% not okay. The way that a person relates to the Torah in one time and one place is completely different than he has to relate to the Torah in a different time and a different place. One more example. When I first came to Eretz Yisrael, so I came in Elul, and my first Sukkot in Eretz Yisrael, I decided that I'm going to celebrate this Sukkot Israeli style, not like in Chutz Laretz, and therefore one of the ways to do that is that my Sukkot decorations should be Israeli Sukkot decorations, not the Sukkot decorations I brought from Chutz Laretz. So I went after Yom Kippur to Mea Shearim to buy Israeli Sukkot decorations. And as I get close to the tables that are lining the streets with all these Sukkot decorations, something hits me that they look very familiar. And as I get closer and closer, they are very familiar. They're Christmas decorations. Not things that look like Christmas decorations, but in the original packing that say Merry Christmas on them. And all these Yerushalmis are buying up these Christmas decorations. I was sure that I was going to go into Mea Shearim on Chol HaMoed and see a sukkah decorated with a little baby and a lot of shepherds around. And they're going to tell me, beautiful, ganze mishpacha, really... Now, I'm sure that if these Yerushalmis went to America in the end of December, they would say, these goyim stole our sukkah decorations. They never saw a Christmas tree. They don't see goyim, notzrim, Christians around. Best, they see Muslims. They have no idea that those decorations have any meaning except that they're sukkah decorations. But if you use those same sukkah decorations in America, there may be a problem with Chukas HaGoyim. So what in one place could be 100% glat kosher, in a different place could be 100% glat treif, because of what the implications are. And therefore, b'chol yom yu beinecha kichadoshim, just like the Rabbeinu Shel Olam, reassessed how you have to relate to the Torah according to the time and the place. And since Klal Yisrael were tired, it was counterproductive to start Matan Torah that day. Let them rest. But a different day, maybe there, don't let them rest. Push them, because they're capable of being pushed. So every day you have to reassess your relationship to Torah based on the circumstances of that time and that place and all the other factors, and decide anew how you're going to relate to the Torah, not because the way I related to it yesterday or in a different place was this way, that's the way I'm going to relate to it today. On the other hand, there's another vort that will seem to be contradictory to this, but it's not. They really go together. It says right after that, Vayisu mirifidim vayavo midbar Sinai. It's already said, right, by Chodesh HaShlishi, Now, if it only would say that pasuk, I would know that they left Rafidim, because you can't be in two places at the same time. So if they came to Midbar Sinai, and I know that in the end of Bishalach, they were in Rafidim, so they must have left Rafidim. So why did the Torah see it necessary to tell me, Vayisu Mirafidim Vayavo Midbar Sinai? I know Vayisu Mirafidim. By implication, coming to Midbar Sinai means they left Rafidim. So why did the Torah have to repeat it, Vayisu Mirafidim? So Rashi says, to tell me the following, that they did tshuva already when they left Rafidim, just like when they came to Har Sinai, they were Bali tshuva. When they left Rafidim, they already had done tshuva. That's what it tells me. Just like when they came to Midbar Sinai, Har Sinai, they were Ke'ish Echad, Belev Echad, totally Balei Tshuva, they already did Tshuva in Rafidim. Always bothered me, who cares? when you do tshuva, it helps retroactively. So what difference does it make if they did the tshuva in Rafidim, or they did the tshuva when they come to Midbar Sinai? In any case, it's going to help retroactively, and it's as if they did the tshuva already in Rafidim. So why does the Torah have to go out of its way to tell me that they didn't do the tshuva in Midbar Sinai, they already did the tshuva in Rafidim? I think it's coming to tell me the following lesson. Many people feel that they would like to make changes in their life, and they would like to do tshuva about certain things that they know need correcting, or they'd like to be machazik themselves, or they'd like to improve, but they feel they just can't do it in the circumstances they're in. They just have to wait for new circumstances. In this place, I can't do it. But it'd be a different place, I'll be able to do it. This time, I can't do it. But a different time, I'll be able to do it. People are fooling themselves. If you can't make that improvement now, then it's not the time and the place, not going to make a difference. You won't do it later either. Most changes are dependent on the person, not on the time and not on the place. And if you make it dependent on time and place, the time will never come and the place will never be right. Now that seems to contradict what I told you before. Because this vort is that a person has to be able to function in all situations. You can't say, I can't do it now because the time and place isn't right. I can do it later. A different time, a different place. But I said that you have to be able to adapt to time and place. The answer is, a person can function in every situation. That doesn't mean you function the same way, but you can function. You can't say, I can't do it now, but later the time and place will enable me to do something. That's not true. Time and place don't enable you to do anything. It's you that either push yourself and you do it, or you don't do it. Time and place aren't going to make that much of a difference. But that doesn't mean that you function the same way in every time and place. For instance, an example where the two things come together. Person wakes up in the morning and they have tremendous problems and they're very depressed and they just can't face the day and they go back to sleep. Sleep the whole day because they just can't face the day to come. Can't face the pressures of life. That's one way of functioning. Another way of functioning is a person gets up in the morning and says, I have a tremendous amount of stress in my life, and I'm really not up to dealing with it today. I think that if I rest today, right, tomorrow I may be better equipped to face the stress and the problems that I have. And he goes back to sleep. Both of these people are spending the day in bed. One is doing it because they've made a conscious decision that this is what they need today based on the situation. They are functioning by staying in bed. And the other one is avoiding having to function and running away from having to face the world. They're both doing the same thing, but one's doing it in a calculated way. He's functioning, but the function for today is to stay in bed. And the other one says, I can't function today. Maybe tomorrow will be different. Tomorrow won't be different than either. So you can do the same thing. But if you're doing it because you can't function and you think that if you'll wait for the right time and place, you'll be able to function, you're fooling yourself. If you're doing it because you've decided that that is the function for today, staying in bed, then that's a different story. Then in every situation, a person should be able to function. The question is, what the function is different for every situation. And sometimes the function is stay in bed. But it's not avoiding running away from functioning. It's using that, what's necessary for that day in a positive way. That's the difference. Okay. The right before Matan Torah, HaKadosh Baruch Hu tells Moshe Rabbeinu, Reid ha'ed ba'am, go down and warn the people again that they shouldn't come up to Har Sinai, because if they even touch the mountain, they're going to be liable to a death penalty. So Moshe Rabbeinu tells the Rabbanu Shalom, I warned them already. We made a gvul, right, a simin around the mountain. People know they're not allowed to come up. They were warned. What's the purpose of doing this again? It's not easy keeping running down this mountain and up that mountain, right? If there's no purpose to it, why should I do it? So Moshe Rabbeinu tying this to the Rabbanu Shalom, the people can't come up. I warned them already. The Rabbanu Shalom ignores him and tells him, get down there and warn them again. So the simple idea is that you warn a person when it's theoretical and you warn them again when it becomes lemaisa. But I think there's a much deeper idea of why Moshe Rabbeinu had to warn the people again. The Medrash says in Tanit Velio, Chayiv Adam Lomar Bishvili Nivra Ha'olam. The Al Yomar, that part of the Medrash you're all familiar with. But the next part, you probably never heard. The Medrash ends, the Al Yomar Ein Trias HaMesim Ve'Ein Olam Haba, and he shouldn't say there's no Trias HaMesim, there's no Olam Haba. Now what in the world does the world being created for me have to do with there being a Trias HaMesim and Olam Haba? If the world's created for me, then there is. And if not, then there isn't. What does one thing have to do with the other? And that's how a person's supposed to walk around with his nose in the air. The world is created for me. That doesn't sound too much of modesty and humility. So why is a person chayiv to say, Bishvili Nivra Ha'olam? The Rabbeinu Yonah says that the incentive to be an Oved Hashem and not to do things that are wrong is only if you recognize your own self-worth. Hakaras Milas Atzmo. It's the first paragraph in Sefer Shari Ho'avoda from the Rabbeinu Yonah. If you don't appreciate the value of your life, then you have no incentive to serve God. If you think you're a nothing and you're worthless, then why would God want a worthless nothing to serve him? And if you think you're good for nothing and you do things that are good for nothing, why should you feel guilty about it? Good for nothing things. Do good for nothing things. The Telzer Rosh Yeshiva says when we say the vidui, Oshamnu, Bogadnu, we end off Avarnu al mitzvosecho umishpotecho hatovim velo shavalonu. So the simple meaning of lo shavalonu is it wasn't worth it. We didn't benefit from it. We thought we'd gain from doing these averas, and in the end we didn't gain anything. Lo hayashaveh, it wasn't worth it. But the Telzer Rosh Yeshiva says it means something else. Lo shavalonu means, yes, I did all these terrible things. But in Yiddish, it's nicht von mir zugepasst. Lo shavalonu. It's not matim. It's not befitting me. That's what it means. Yeah, I did all these things, but it's not me. That's not befitting. That's not what I'm capable of. I'm capable of doing much better. Because if you don't think you're capable of doing better, what's there to confess? Why should you feel guilty? That's what I'm capable of doing. But if I understand that it's not befitting me, it's not shaveh to me, this is not what's befitting me, it's not matim for me, then you can feel guilty, then you can do tshuva. So the first foundation of Avodas Hashem is recognizing your own self-worth. How much self-worth does a person have? So that's what a person has to say, Bishvili Nivra Ha'olam. That's not gaiva. Gaiva is, I'm important because I made myself important, and that gives me rights. That's gaiva. Self-esteem is, I'm important because God made me important, and that gives me responsibility. That's self-esteem. Bishvili Nivra Ha'olam means that I'm one human being, and the world was created for one human being. That means that I'm pretty important, and I have tremendous responsibility in God's eyes, because he created everything for my sake. That makes me extremely responsible. That's what it means. And if I believe that human life is important, then I can believe the Torah is important. Because in a certain way, the way to describe the Torah is the following. When you buy a car, you get a nice big book with it that tells you how to use the car properly. The owner's manual to the book. When God created the world, he also wrote an owner's manual to the world to tell you how to deal with it. He designed the world. So he can tell you what he designed the world to do. What he designed you to eat and to wear and to think and to say. Just like the Ford Motor Company designed the car, they can tell you what kind of gasoline they designed it to run on, and you could do whatever you want. You could put sugar in the gas tank, but it's not going to go anywhere. You could put the wrong grade of gas in the gas tank, and it will go. It'll burn out the motor eventually. So the Rabban Shalom created the world, and he designed it a certain way, and he gave us an owner's manual to the world that's called the Torah. And he told us, look, you can do what you want. I gave you free choice. But I designed the world to run this way. This is what you're supposed to wear. This is when you're supposed to work. This is what you're supposed to eat. And so on and so on. You can choose not to do that. But I designed the world. You didn't design it. So I'm telling you what I designed it to do. This is what it runs on. So the Torah is the owner's manual to the world. When you buy a pack of gum, it does not come even with one page of instructions how to chew it properly. Or when you buy a box of tissues, it does not come with a page of instructions on how to blow your nose and how to take care of the tissues. Why not? Why does a car come with a big, thick book that tells you how to care for it and how to use it properly, and a pack of gum and a box of tissues doesn't? Very simple. Because not worth the instructions. If you mischew the gum, buy another one. If you abuse the tissues, buy another pack. But if you abuse your car, it's not so easy to buy another one. So the more important the thing, the more important the instructions that go with it. The less important the thing, the less important the instructions. If the Torah is the owner's manual to human life, then if human life is important, then the Torah is important. And if human life isn't important, then the Torah is not important. How could the instructions for an unimportant life be important? Therefore, right before Matan Torah, that's why a person has to say, the world was created for me, and therefore, there must be a Tchias HaMeisim, there must be an Olam Haba. It can't be that the whole world was created for one human being for 120 years. All of the worlds for 120 years. There must be something eternal about this. Because if human life is as important as an ant, you don't bring an ant back for an encore. So why should there be a Tchias HaMeisim? Why should there be an Olam Haba? And that's why right before Matan Torah, the Rabban Shalom told Moshe Rabbeinu, go down and warn the people again that Chas V'Shalom, one Jew, will touch the mountain and be liable to a death penalty. In my estimation, that's like a multitude of people. Because I want them to know how important their lives are to me. Because if they understand how important they are, then they can understand how important the Torah is. Because the Torah is the owner's manual to their lives. And if they don't consider their life important in my eyes, then how important could the Torah be? That's why the Rabban Shalom wanted Moshe to go in and impress them again. The Rabban Shalom is very concerned that you don't do something that would forfeit your life. Because your life in his eyes is of supreme importance. If that's the case, then the instructions to that life is also important. That's why Moshe had to warn them again right before Matan Torah. Okay. The most important occurrence in history, not Jewish history, in history, was the giving of the Torah. Now, I would think that the rabbis would have wanted to make something special about the giving of the Torah. And they should have made a parsha of Matan Torah that started Bachodesh HaShlishi and ended after the giving of the Torah. And that would have been a parsha just to itself. Instead, they tacked on the giving of the Torah after Vayishma Yisro. We start with this thing about Yisro, which, according to some opinions, it didn't even happen that before the Torah was given. It happened afterwards. So for some reason, the rabbis decided we got to put this, right, or the Torah decided has to put this before the giving of the Torah, even though it's not in the right order. And we're going to make this all the parsha, so this week when we lane Mamash Matan Torah, the first two aliyahs have nothing to do with Matan Torah, do with Yisro. Wouldn't it be nice to put Yisro like last week's Sedra, finish off, and then just have this week's Sedra dedicated to this tremendous occasion? Why is it tacked on? So the parsha starts Vayishma Yisro, and the Gemara and the Medrash asks, V'chi Yisro levad shama? Yisro heard everything that God did. Yisro was the only person who heard it. The whole world heard what God did. The Kriyas Yam Suf was Shamu Amim Yudazim. Rachav tells the spies that Yoshua said, since the time that God dried up the Red Sea for you, we have no more courage. So obviously everybody heard about it. It says in the Shira, Shamu Amim Yirgazun, right? Everybody, the Kananim, the Moavim, everybody heard about it. So what does it say, Vayishma Yisrael? Says the Medrash, because everybody heard it, but it made no impression on them. They didn't listen. And Yisrael heard and it made an impression. That's the difference. You can hear something, but sometimes you miss the point and you don't realize that it's talking to you. Same thing we said. You can hear, you know, but God's talking to me. You know where the classic case of that is, like Cain. Says that Cain was very upset that God accepted Hevel's, what's it called, sacrifice and not his. He was really upset. So God gave him the first Musar Shmuz in history. And he said to him, look, Cain, Imtativ Se'es, you want to be accepted? You want to rise up? Better your ways. Don't blame your brother. I could accept both of your sacrifices. I didn't accept his at the expense of yours. You could both be accepted. You want to do better? You raise yourself up. The imlav, and if you don't, lepesach chatas rovet, the yetzirah is just waiting for you. First real ethical musa shmuz in history. Right after that, it says vayomer Cain al Hevel achiv. Cain said something to Hevel, and then it says when they were in the field, Cain killed Hevel. So what was the sequence? God speaks to Cain. Cain says something to Hevel. Then they're in the field, and Cain kills Hevel. So there's medrashim. There's something missing over here. What did he say? So the Medrashim say they started to argue about how to split up the world. There are two sons, they're going to get the whole Yerusha. So Cain said, I'll take the what's it called, the land, you take the movable property. And they said, fine, so get your movable property off my land. And I said, get your feet off my land. Stop using my movable property. So they started arguing. Right, they couldn't realize they had the whole world. They're arguing over who's going to get what, or they were arguing about who's going to get the Beis Hamikdash, the place of Eretz Yisrael, the Beis Hamikdash. They were fighting already over that, and that makes sense because of this argument. Cain ended up killing Hevel, but all of that's Midrashim. It doesn't say that in the Torah. It has to be a simple meaning besides the Midrash. What's the Pshat? Torah has to be understood without anything added. What does it mean? What's the simple meaning? Says the Ibn Ezra, the simple meaning is God told Cain this Musar, and Cain went and told it to Hevel. It doesn't make sense. If Cain told the Musar over to Hevel, why should that be what caused them to kill him? If the sequence doesn't go, God told Musar to Cain, Cain told the Musar over to Hevel, and then when they're in the field, he killed him. Doesn't follow. The answer is it follows very nicely. You know why? Because when God said the Musar to Cain, he said, oh wow, that's really great things, but I don't need it. It obviously doesn't mean me, right? I don't need that Musar. And I'm not going to go tell my parents. So there's only one other person, my brother. Mislama, God told it to me to tell it over to him. He needs it. So Cain went to Hevel and he said, look, God just told me something really, really interesting. But I obviously don't need it. Maybe meant you. So you, what's it called? Here's what God said to you. I remember that when I was a younger rabbi in Miami, so sometimes somebody did something in the Kehillah and they needed to be told off. But I was young and they were older than me and I felt intimidated to go and tell them off. So I used my drush on Shabbos for that purpose. Not, you know, obviously obvious, but I got the message across and I figured nobody knew, you know, I was talking about this person or that person or whatever, but I figured the people, if the shoe fit, they get the message. And inevitably, every time I tried this, and afterwards I stopped doing it because it was absurd, right? The people used to come after shul, you know, to say good Shabbos, and I see them have a big smile on their face. The people that I was really giving it to. They came over and they said, Rabbi, you really gave it to them. I hope the people that needed that got the message. And I'm thinking to myself, I know they didn't. It was you. That's the way people are. You know, you really, Cain comes, well, God, you really gave it to Hevel. I'll give him the message because I surely don't need this.
That's why you kill.
What?
That's why you kill.
So because if you don't hear the Musar, then in the end, that's what ended up. I was upset with Hevel. If I would have listened to the Musar, it would have calmed me down. But I didn't listen to it. I thought I was a messenger to tell it to Hevel. So Cain didn't get the Musar, and the Mela, in the end, he ended up killing Hevel because of what he was upset to begin with. Didn't calm him down. I don't think God's talking to me. That's why Vayishma Yisro. Yisro was not like that. He heard God talking to him, and nobody else heard that. God can talk to you directly. If you don't listen and don't think he's talking to you, it's worthless. Therefore, before the Torah was given, and God came and spoke for the first and last time directly to an entire people, if you don't learn Vayishma Yisro first, then it's all wasted. It's all meaningless. Because God can talk, but if you don't listen, you're not going to get the message. So first we have to learn from Yisro how to listen. And then it becomes significant to have God talking. That's why the Torah and the Rabbanim put Vayishma Yisro as the preface to the giving of the Torah, because without that, the giving of the Torah is going to be irrelevant.
Here's the article.
Thanks.
And I copied this for you.
What about the American one? What does that mean?